Welcome to Measuring Success Right, the official podcast of the Marriott Student Review, a podcast for students by students, where we connect the leaders of tomorrow with the issues of today.
We have climbed mountains and we've touched stars, and members of this club have tugged and pushed all along the way.
Hello and welcome to Measuring Success Right. I'm Grant Frazier.
And I'm Spencer McWilliams.
And we are so excited for today's episode. So today, Spencer, we are going to be talking about the life of Esther Peterson. Have you ever heard of her before?
I have not.
Okay, well, so that means that this is going to be a fun, fresh episode. So today, instead of having a guest on, we're going to be trying to kind of do an interview, quote-unquote, with a historical figure, somebody who passed away in 1997. Yeah. So Esther Peterson is a famous women's rights advocate. She went to BYU in Utah back in the 1920s. And she fought for consumer protection across the United States. But so I kind of want to start with a little high level of her life. Do you feel ready to get into it?
Yeah, I'm excited to hear about her.
All right. Esther Peterson. She was born the daughter of Danish immigrants. And she was born in Provo, Utah, actually. And she grew up here. She grew up in Utah. And one of the things that was like very big in her life was fighting for unions, you know? So she was like fighting to help protect people who weren't being treated fairly by their bosses and by like CEOs, by company heads. Okay, so kind of the thing that I want to talk about first is her early life and how it like led to her being very involved in unions and like fighting for consumer protections as well as like worker protections. And she was very focused on issues of feminism and like making sure that women were treated fairly in the workplace. But something that's funny is that when she was younger, she kind of, you know, it's a very conservative area in Utah, right? And
yes.
The conservative movement at that time was not a big fan of unions. So like they kind of thought like you work for a company and that's your choice. Like you don't have any rights in that relationship, really. It's like the boss kind of gets to decide, and if you don't like it, you can go work somewhere else, which kind of makes sense, you know. But when people are in poverty and people don't have a lot of options, you know, they take the job that they can. But so it's very funny that Esther, she became a union advocate, but she talks about the fact that when she was younger, she said, quote, "I was raised thinking that strikers had bombs in their pockets and that they were all communists."
Oh my gosh.
Do you think that that's true about union advocates?
No.
I don't know. No, you don't think so?
Oh, I thought that question was part of her quote. No. And I was like, she's bold.
She's bold. No, she was 12 years old and she like thought that was like, she just kind of had that idea when she was younger that like unions and people fighting for it, they were all communists, you know?
She was
like
12?
She was 12. Like this was kind of like before she became a union advocate, she grew up not thinking that unions were a good thing, you know? So she grew up thinking that like unions were all people trying to steal from employers, you know, kind of communists. And so there was a lot of anti-communism at this time. Esther Peterson, she ends up going to Brigham Young University, getting a degree in physical education. And again, at this time, it's not very common for women to go to college and to get a degree. But she gets a degree there, and then she also goes after that to Columbia University, and she gets her master's. Okay, and so after she graduates in 1930 from Columbia University, she gets married to a man named Oliver Peterson, and so her name goes from Esther Egertson to Esther Egertson Peterson.
Oh, Peterson.
Yeah.
That just even sounds like famous.
Oh yeah, it's a good name. In 1932, her and her husband, they moved to Boston, where she taught at a prep school, and she volunteered at the YWCA. So, you know, the YMCA, but the YWCA. Harder to make into a song, but
a little bit.
A little bit. So she is a teacher there. This is actually kind of the place where her propensity towards unions and where her passion for unionization comes. And there's a very cool story here. So she teaches a group of young women at the organization. And one night at one of her classes, one of the students doesn't show up to the meeting. And so she contacts the student, says, "Hey, why didn't you show up?" And she finds out that the student had to miss class because she was striking for her organization, like trying to unionize and trying to fight for better wages. So there's a very interesting little story there. So this young girl, she worked sewing dresses for a company, and they were paid $1.32 for every single dress or every dozen dresses that they made. So not a lot of money, right? A dozen dresses. And so I ran that through the inflation calculator, you know, I went online. And even now that's like $25. So that's like a little bit over $2 per dress that they were getting paid. Already not a lot.
Yeah.
But so the incident that makes them decide to strike for better pay and for better hours, is the fact that the company says, okay, you can no longer put square pockets onto the dresses. They need to all be heart-shaped. And so they're saying, like, well, a square is very easy to sew, but a heart takes a lot longer.
Yeah.
Like, that's more difficult. Do you have any experience in sewing? I don't.
My mom used to sew a lot of my stuff, and my sister's stuff, but I don't know personally how to sew, but from watching her, it's not easy when you're not doing shapes that are just already, like, Like a square, like a pocket square.
Yeah, a square is a lot easier to sew. I think I could figure that out too. You know, it's not as easy to do, or it's much easier to do a square than it is to do a heart. But so these women were really frustrated because, like, they had to sew all of these dresses. They weren't getting good pay already. And then having to put the heart on it instead of squares meant that they had to take more time and that they would get paid less money because it takes them longer to make each individual dress. She, you know, like, when she grew up, she didn't care about unions. She thought that they were people who were greedy, you know, and wanted to take more from their employer, be lazy. So after this one night where the student doesn't show up to class, she goes to the girl's house and she finds the group of women who are organizing the union. And the next morning, Esther Peterson, our hero, is out on the picket line with them, fighting for women's rights, fighting for the rights of these women in these factories. So next, I want to read a quote from UtahWomen'sHistory.org. You know, they have a whole section about Esther because, you know, she's a very important person in Utah history. From this paragraph in the Utah Women's History website about Esther. The next morning, when the garment workers went on strike, Esther helped to organize and join them on the picket line. She saw how by working together, these women's voices were powerful. This Heartbreakers Strike, quote unquote, that's the name. It's kind of a fun name, right? They called it the Heartbreakers Strike because, you know, the heart's on the pockets anyway. Clever. It inspired Esther to become a real labor activist. And this is a quote from her. I knew that the fathers of the kids at the prep school were the ones who were doing the exploiting. Their kids would come to school with chauffeurs in the morning and their fathers still couldn't pay a minimum wage. Come on. She's funny.
Come on.
You'll see it in a little bit. We'll get into some interviews with her. Like, she's funny, she's witty, and she just is bold. I love her. But so she said that, I decided that they had to have a voice, the working people. I felt that women were left out. They got the low end of everything. And so then after this incident, she gets involved with the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, which might sound like a kind of specific organization, but, like, lots of garments were all made by, like, women's organizations back in the day, you know, or organizations that hired women, but were still run by men, you know, so that's part of the issue. And she spent her summers teaching classes ranging from economics to poetry at the summer school for women, workers, and industry. So, how are you feeling about Esther so far? Like, just from this little bit early on in her life.
Well, she definitely sounds like a go-getter, for sure. And she also is someone that is very aware of what's going on around her and aware of the things that, especially of the things that weren't right that were going around her, or going on around her. I really liked how she, or when you told me about how she followed up with that student who wasn't able to make it to the class, and then she saw what the student was doing and just, like, went in and just joined her. And then that just set off her whole activism towards women's rights and labor. So that's very impressive, because I feel like it's not, I mean, her personality just shows that that's just the type of person that she is.
And she, like, I don't know, I would love to have her as a teacher, you know?
Oh,
it's like,
I know.
You don't show up to class one night and then she's, like, organizing in the union with you the next morning.
Yeah, for
real. That's amazing. She's really awesome. Like, she just doesn't let anything stop her. I don't know. And I think it's also awesome that her husband was somebody, she married well, you know, to somebody who didn't, like, hate the fact that she was, like, fighting for women's rights, you know? Like, that's kind of hard at the time. A lot of women were forced into just, like, only being housewives, you know, not able to get a career.
Yeah.
All right, so we've gotten a little bit of her background working in unions. And so in 1938, she starts working for the American Federation of Teachers as a paid organizer in New England, which means, like, she kind of went around and tried to, like, rally up people, like, tried to get people to, like, join the teachers' unions, you know, trying to get, like, teachers to, I don't know, unionize, like, trying to get teachers to get fair wages, trying to just fight for teachers' rights and to, like, hear what the issues were that teachers were dealing with. Pretty cool. She's just, like, doing a lot of things that are very selfless all the time.
Oh, yeah.
But it's, like, really tough for her, because at this time, women aren't paid very much. So she talks about the fact that she's lucky that her husband was making good money, because she would be paid $15 a week to be doing this job, traveling around New England. And the cost of just, like, hiring somebody to take care of her child was $20 a week. So she's losing money, really, by, like, taking this job. But
she was so passionate about it that she just went ahead and did it, though.
She just went ahead and did it. And this is, like, one of the things that also inspires her to make more change, is that she ends up eventually fighting for legislation to strengthen something called the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is, you know, a lot of the rules about how an employer can, like, pay an employee, like, how you're paid for your work, like, making sure that there's fair standards for who gets paid how much, and, like, making sure that this type of situation doesn't happen nearly as often.
Yeah.
So, after kind of this period in her life, in 1944, she and her family, they moved to Washington, D.C. because of her husband's job.
Yeah.
But she ends up becoming the first lobbyist for the National Labor Relations Board, which is, again, another organization, like, within the federal government this time that, like, fights to, or, like, tries to understand the relationship between employers and employees.
Mm-hmm.
and tries to fight for, hopefully, you know, employees' rights. You know, try to fight to make sure that people have a fair, safe workplace. So it's kind of crazy. She just ends up, like, hopping in there, you know? Like, she really just ends up in all of these different organizations all the time.
I can't even keep track of how many you have.
I know.
You've already mentioned, so that's incredible.
So, okay, she walks into her first meeting of the National Labor Relations Board, all right? And at the first meeting, when she walks into the room, all the men stood up when she walked in. And she didn't want to be treated differently, and so she said, "Please don't stand up for me. I don't intend to stand up for you."
Oh,
it's kind of a good kind of a good line, right?
That is so funny. She's also, that'd be just so uncomfortable just walking in, like, everyone just stands up and...
Yeah, everyone just stands up, and she's just like...
She's like, come on, like, don't treat me, you don't have to treat me any other...
Yeah, just treat me like I'm a member of this board,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's just a great example of her wit, you know, and the ability she has to be, like, a little bit snappy, but not ever rude. I don't know, she's great. I love her. And she just doesn't really care about, like, how other people fully perceive her, you know?
Yeah.
So I think so far she's measuring success, right? Would you say so?
Oh, yeah. I think that's especially the really hard part, is not caring what other people perceive of you, because, I don't know, that's something that takes a lot of practice and doesn't come naturally as it does to other people, mm-hmm. or as it does to Esther, as it sounds.
Absolutely. And she... One thing that I love about her is just the fact that she kind of follows in the footsteps of a lot of, like, earlier women's rights advocates in Utah. Some might remember that I did an episode with Diana Douglas, who just wrote did a podcast series called Zion Suffragists, which is about a lot of the early women activists in Utah and how they made Utah the first state to allow women to vote and how they fought for women to, like, be able to have careers. And Esther Peterson really... One of the cool things that she fights for is the idea of allowing, or, like, making being a homemaker, being somebody who stays at home, into an empowering thing. And there's this really, really great snippet that I want to share, just talk about, from a speech that she gave actually in Salt Lake City to the Future Homemakers of America conference, which, never heard of that before, but sounds kind
of
fun, right?
Future Farmers of America.
I don't know that they're related, but, you know.
I don't think they are, but that... Future Homemakers of America,
we should bring it back.
Yeah, no. We should bring it back.
So she kind of starts this speech by talking about the fact that a lot of women don't think that they should go to college because they're like, oh, I just want to live at home. I want to be a homemaker. And she says, well, even if you want to be a homemaker, I think you should still go to college. And she says, like, that attitude of not wanting to go to college because you want to be a homemaker is ... the beginning of a vicious circle. The homemaker of today usually suffers from a terrible inferiority complex. When people ask her what she does, she says apologetically, "I'm just a housewife."
Aww.
First, it's kind of sad, right?
Oh, yeah.
I know. And so she's really trying to say, no, this is like an admirable thing that you're doing. The next line makes me laugh. First of all, I quarrel with the word housewife. Nobody is married to a house. If married at all, it's to a man. So a homemaker is a better word, and it covers both single and married people.
Yeah, that's great that she mentions that.
Right? And I never thought about that. But yeah, housewife does seem like more of a, I don't know, it's a lesser term, you know?
Yeah.
It's like you're just a wife who you take care of the house. I don't know. But
yeah
so she's right. You know, nobody's married to a house. People are married to people. And then she continues, second, although homemakers are not listed as part of the labor force, they actually constitute the largest single occupational group in our society. Homemakers, therefore, for their own morale, need to look at themselves in the role of holding a job in the home. They need to realize that in their job, they are in a position of almost frightening power and responsibility. And if anyone needs education for her job, it is the homemaker. Thoughts?
Boom.
Yeah?
Yes.
Mic drop moment.
No,
kinda, right?
Really. I feel like if I was there, I would just start clapping right away. No, I love that. Yeah. I love how she, first of all, I love how she just changes the wording of housewife to homemaker. Because,
mm-hmm.
first of all, that is just a strong transition of, you're not married to the house.
Like, yes.
You are the homemaker, but you also deserve to have, like, as she said, like, an education as well for that job, even if you are just staying at home.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's, like, for some reason, I wasn't expecting that from her. I wasn't expecting to hear that. I was expecting, like, okay, well, you should also get a degree to get a job just in case, like, all of these things fall out, and then
mm-hmm.
you can be a homemaker. But she said, like, that's important to have, even if you are just going to be a homemaker and just stay at home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't want to get too much into politics, but it's an important part of her life, and the fact that she was a Democrat and was proudly so. And she campaigned for a lot of politicians, including Al Gore, who was running for president against George Bush very late in her life. It's just important, I think, to draw the through line of the fact that, like, she is fighting for the fact that homemaker is a job, and it's, like, the largest job force in the country when you think about it.
Yes.
And it's an idea that's kind of actually just now gaining a little bit of steam. And I don't know that anything will come of it, but I believe it was Mitt Romney and a group of Democrats, actually, like kind of a bipartisan coalition, created a child tax credit proposal, which is the idea that, you know, for every child that you have, you get $600 a month, you know? And it's like you are being paid for the fact that you are staying at home and having a child. And so that's kind of a recognition of this idea that, you know, being a homemaker is a job and that we need people to have children in this country. So, like, why not help people do it? Why not pay them for the fact that they're creating, like, the next generation of the workforce, you know? It's like, yeah. I don't know.
It's a big responsibility and a very, I mean, I'm not a parent yet, but I can just imagine, or I don't know, maybe I can't imagine, I can't imagine just how much, like, how hard that's going to be when you are a parent. Because you are literally raising the next generation of people, like you said.
Absolutely. So, yeah, we love her. We love this speech. I wish I could share all of it, but, you know, it's a podcast. We've got some time limitations, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a video where Esther Peterson is being interviewed in 1969. So it's a long time ago. It's some old audio. And she's being asked about talking about women's participation in the labor force, you know? So, like, as women are starting to more and more get into the workforce, she's just talking about it and a lot of the things that she did over her career to help with women participating in the workforce. So we'll give it a listen.
We have a full economy now, and we have almost full employment, and women always benefit when the economy is booming. Mm-hmm. Remember during the war, when jobs were scarce, women made great progress, and of course women make greater progress during times of full employment and when the economy is booming. But I think we're making progress in other ways too, because now we have on the books some laws that really protect women. We have the equal pay law, for example, that there shall be a rate for the job, and it is illegal for two people to perform the same job and there be a one rate for a woman and another rate for a man. Mm-hmm. And so the principle of the rate for the job has been established in law. We still have some rather rough cases on what is the same and what is equal that have to be decided by the courts. But nevertheless, there is a principle established. There also is a principle established that there shall be no discrimination against women in employment on federal contracts. We say that you can't discriminate against people on a basis of race or religion and sex as well. And we have just now issued the guidelines. I call them the guidelines for the gals.
It's a good line, right?
Guidelines for the gals.
So she mentions in this video the fact that women tend to do very well in full economies and booming economies. Yeah. And it's something that actually kind of ties into an event that's happened in the last year, which I'm not sure if you know this, but there was a pandemic, something called COVID-19.
Oh, yeah.
Have you had a chance to hear about that, read anything?
You know, I've just heard a little bit about it.
Okay. Well, I can explain it to you. No, I'm kidding. But so something that is to be noted about all of the job losses from 2020 is that it kind of disproportionately affected women, largely. Mm. Like, I remember there was one month where women were pretty much 90%+ of all of the job losses for the month. And
Overall,
in the pandemic, women lost a million jobs more than men did, which pretty, yeah.
Wow, I actually did not know that, so that's really...
Mm-hmm. It's not something that got a lot of coverage, but, I mean, if you think about it, like, that's okay. A lot of the roles that are traditionally occupied by women were some of the first to go during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Servers, hostesses, like nurses even, you know, burnout. They were the ones who lost much worse than men did, and it's something that is kind of talked about a lot whenever there's a recession, and there's a sociologist who has kind of dubbed the term she-cession, you know, the idea that it disproportionately affects women, and it just is one of those things where, like, in a full economy, women are able to get jobs, but when jobs are tighter, it's mostly men who lose less, you know? It's the women who lose a lot more and who have less security in their jobs and fields. So, yeah, so you hadn't had a chance, you didn't hear, yeah.
No, yeah, I didn't really, of course, lots was going on during that time, and I had heard of all the job losses, but I didn't know that it was disproportionate.
Mm-hmm. And this one might be perceived as political by some, but I thought it was a powerful quote given at the beginning of this article that we're looking at as we talk about the job losses. It's by sociologist Jessica Calarco, and she says that, quote, other countries have social safety nets, the U.S. has women. Is that a quote that you've ever heard before?
No.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting. It's the idea that, you know, in a lot of other countries, they do have, like, paid maternity leave that's, like, much better than we have in the United States. They have child tax credits. They have, like systems that can help during a downturn in the economy. But in the United States, what really happens usually is it seems like women just kind of lose their jobs and then they go and they take care of the children and they're not able to participate, you know? Yeah. So the women kind of act as the U.S. social safety net.
Oh, that's interesting.
Do you think that women that do work in the home and also continue their job with a role as mother and homemaker have to be multifaceted?
Well, I think they do, but this depends on the woman. You see, I think it's awful for us to put everyone into one category. Some of us can and some of us can't. We're all different, and it's wrong for us to make what is good for me may not be good for you, and what I can organize my time to do, what I find satisfying may not be for another one. And I don't like us to put people and to say all women are this way or that way, but I do think to be able to manage a home and a job does require a good deal of work. But it depends again on your relationship to your husband. And if you have a kind of husband, I should say that I have, sort of believes in partnership, that makes a big difference.
And you can kind of see again in this, she talks about the fact that like, well, no, I mean, every woman's career or every woman's life path is different. And it's wrong for me to say that every woman needs to have a career or every woman needs to be a homemaker.
Yes, I think she answered that question just like beautifully.
So well, right?
She's not going to categorize all women are this, all women are that. She's like, it really just depends.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like the big thing that she fights for is women should have the right to do whatever they want in that aspect, though.
Exactly.
You know, it's like if you're a homemaker, it doesn't mean you're failing as a feminist woman, right?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously I am a man, so everything I say is a man's perspective trying to understand. Yeah, she's just saying that like women should have the right to get a career if they want to and to be paid the same wage as a man.
And I feel like as a woman, this is like very empowering to hear because there is that kind of like, I wouldn't say debate or maybe there is of like women should have a career or like a good woman should be a career oriented or like a good woman should be a mom, a stay-at-home mom. A good woman could be both, a good woman could be either, or it doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm. And I know that, like, obviously, again, a man, but my women friends who I have talked to at university who are in, like, humanities-centered majors and whatnot have said at times, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm doing bad or, like, I'm not doing right by my gender because I'm not, like, in a STEM field, you know? Like, I'm not doing science or technology. But I don't know. That seems like she's kind of answering that saying, hey, well, you have the right to do it if you want to, but you don't need to do it and you're not failing womankind. Would you agree with that?
Oh, that is actually something that I feel a lot. And so hearing you say that you have friends that have felt like that, that is, as an art history major and having, and I have a lot of women friends that are just killing it in the career field. And I love that. And I'm so like amazed by all of these powerful women that can do that kind of stuff. But then, I don't know, sometimes I feel like, I mean, I do have that really big desire to be a mother and to have that role and to have that be a pretty much a primary role in my life, and sometimes it's hard to feel like, oh, maybe I should be doing more, but I don't know. Hearing Esther say that is just kind of like, well, you know what, like I have the right to do with whatever I want, and if I just want to be a mom, that is fine. But even if I change my mind, maybe in the middle of my motherhood, that's okay too.
Wait, so podcasting is not going to be your primary career? You're not going to?
You know what? Unfortunately.
Okay. Well, what are we doing here then? And I think it's worth noting that Esther is kind of being modest talking about the fact that the Equal Pay Act was passed because she actually drafted it. She's the one who wrote the Equal Pay Act of 1963. Like, one of the biggest pieces of legislation, like, in, I don't know, the 20th century. Like, it's a huge one. It's referenced all the time today. And it's a big reason why women are able to, like, participate in the workforce with a lot more fairness than they did back in the day. Back then, like, I mean, now there are still cases of industries where it seems like women are, you know, underpaid, you know, on larger levels. But like the Equal Pay Act makes it so that an employer can't just say, no, you get $15 an hour and the man gets $25 an hour, you know?
Like, no.
No. Yeah, exactly. So the bill was drafted by Esther Peterson on behalf of the Kennedy administration. So John F. Kennedy is like the one who asked her to write this. And then he pushed it and it was modified a little bit by Congress and it was signed into law on June 10th, 1963. So pretty cool, right?
Yeah, that is really cool.
Yeah, so due to Esther's influence and a lot of the work that she did early on, like working with labor unions and whatnot, President Kennedy, he created an entire commission called the Presidential Commission on the Status of Women. So he creates this commission, the Presidential Commission on the Status of Women, and he selects Esther to like be one of the lead members of this panel. And so she goes around the country and she hosts hearings talking about issues and the problems that working women are facing. And so this created a report that ended up like being a best-selling report, which is not usual. You know, like tons of people across the country read this, outlining the need and steps to improve childcare quality and availability, equal pay, and to end racial and gender workplace discrimination. So again, crazy ahead of her time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, she really was.
Oh, she's just so great. And I think one thing that I love the most is that she really cares about, like, going to the places where people are affected by this. She's not, like, just sitting in Washington, D.C.
and just saying stuff and not actually seeing and going and doing.
Exactly, yeah. Like, all of her work is informed by the fact that she was fighting with women and unions, like, throughout her whole life, you know? So she, like, knows what she's doing. She goes out and still talks to more people before she creates this report that ends up being super influential in a lot of the, like, standards for labor that we have today.
I think that just reflects, like, what you said at the beginning of her story, how she heard about what her student was doing and then just went out and did it. So that, like, just definitely, that, like, literally just showed her personality.
And then even after after John F. Kennedy dies, after he's assassinated, she is appointed to be the presidential assistant on consumer matters by President Lyndon B. Johnson, and served in that role under Jimmy Carter as well. So she's just, like,
she was there for a while.
An incredibly important woman. And it's a real surprise to me that I haven't heard about her before today.
Me neither.
So this clip comes from a presentation, The 70-Year Perspective of Women in Transition, which is just a panel from the Women's National Democratic Club, where they have on a lot of, like, leaders in women's rights and advocates to talk about who they are. And so this is from a 10-minute speech that she gave there.
What changes have taken place in my lifetime that I've experienced and that I have witnessed? My son Eric, just coming back from a big international trip to Fiji, he said, "Mother, I know now what you've been working for and talking about all this time." "What?" He said, "When I got on that big transport plane, I looked into the cockpit, and here was the pilot and the co-pilot, both young, attractive women."
Funny line, right? She knows how to get the crowd laughing.
Yeah.
And he said, "Mama, now I know, because there was a young girl looking, and he said, I could see on that young girl's face, that's what I want to be someday." So I felt like we have opened doors, haven't we? We have helped move so many of these things. We can be proud of our club's record and its history. We helped women, especially with the help of Mrs. Roosevelt and her wonderful work at the UN, her wonderful international leadership on human rights, and if I may say personally, her simply magnificent leadership on the President's Commission on the Status of Women. That land historical document that I think, says Esther speaking, no, it's true, paved the way, I think, for the women's movement today. At least it helped pave the way. We have climbed mountains and we've touched stars, and members of this club have tugged and pushed all along the way.
So she kind of goes through a lot of the history of the different organizations that she worked for, but she really just kind of talks throughout the speech about how much has changed. And I mean, can you imagine going from being born in 1906 and living all the way till 1997? And this is in 1992, so it's
like so much has happened since then.
She lives through like two completely radically different worlds, and it's amazing to just kind of see her towards the end of her life talking about how proud she is and how happy she is of the work they were able to accomplish.
Yeah.
So I think it's tough because there's a lot that I want to talk about with Esther Peterson, things we didn't get to. She fought to raise the minimum wage from 40 cents to 75 cents. So, I mean, that's a very different fight than the one we're having now. But she really just kind of spanned a lot of different aspects of our government and of, like, the way that we think about the workforce and labor and consumer preferences and, like, protections. She really just had a much bigger hand in shaping the modern world than I think I knew ever, you know, in shaping America the way that it is today.
Yeah, I don't doubt that there is, like, countless other things that we could have talked about that she had done that contributed to all of that. But I was so glad to learn about her today, and it makes me just want to, like, especially look up more interviews with her. Because I think that that last video that we just did, or that we just listened to, that first part of her talking about how much has changed, it just, like, I don't know, it just made me think that, yeah, a lot has, well, during her lifetime, and I guess from then to now, a lot has changed too, but there is a lot that I feel like we're still working on, but just to see how much has changed that she has made is incredible.
And it kind of gives you hope, you know?
It's yeah, like that's what I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, we get caught up in, like, the things haven't changed in 1 year or five years, but she was on a much larger time scale than that, and she saw a lot of things happen, and she fought for them.
Yeah.
And so I think it gives me some hope that, you know, like, things like this are worth fighting for, and even though things seem, like, immovable and impossible, like, things can change, and you can fight for them.
Yeah.
So we love Esther Peterson. Any closing thoughts on her? Anything else you thought about her?
No, I just thank you, Grant, so much for teaching us a lot about her. I know I've just learned a lot, and I also wonder why we have not heard much about her, but mm-hmm. I'm so glad that we did today.
Of course, and I'm frustrated. We didn't even get that much into the consumer protection, you know? We didn't get into all the stuff she did about nutrition labels, and that stuff was awesome. But no, we'll talk about that at another date.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, well, so I think that is it for today. So that wraps it up for today's episode on Esther Peterson. I guess until next week, I'm Grant Frazier.
And I'm Spencer McWilliams.
And thank you all so much for listening to Measuring Success Right. We will see you all next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Make sure you subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or SoundCloud so you never miss an episode. Be a friend and tell a friend about Measuring Success Right.
This podcast is a project of the Marriott Student Review at Brigham Young University. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Marriott Student Review or online at marriottstudentreview.org.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect official policy or position of Brigham Young University or The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.